Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
One of the things that I love about Boston is the incredible wealth of knowledge in and around the city, and our next guest is a perfect example. Randall Kennedy is an author and a professor at Harvard Law School. Kennedy has spent decades studying and writing about prominent Black leaders throughout our nation's history and how our society has handled race, past and present. Kennedy's new book is a collection of essays that he has written along the way titled Say It Loud, on race, law, history, and culture. We are looking forward to having a conversation with him about it today. Do we have Professor Kennedy? Professor Kennedy, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me on.
It's great to have you on. We're getting a little bit of echo, so in a minute I may have to let you go. Let's see how we do with this. We might have to bring you back, but let's start. The book is called Say It Loud, which is obviously a reference to the James Brown song, and I want to ask you to tell our listeners, what are you saying loud with this book?
I'm saying loud that the race question has been a central question in American life since the beginning of the country. It remains a central question, and it's a complicated question, and we have to be willing to deal with our issues with a certain amount of patience, a certain amount of willingness to deal with tension and complication. Those are some of the things that I'm trying to say in this set of essays.
So the book really leans into two of the words you just used, complexity and tension. You do not shy away from sort of fully looking at what's at play in the major racial questions of the day, of the last couple hundred years. You don't go for easy answers. It would be very satisfying if you did go for easy answers. Did you expect the essays in this book, in this compilation, to kind of run against the grain of our hunger for resolution today?
Well, I don't know. I don't think about it that way. To tell you the truth, I'm seeking self-clarification. A lot of these essays began as discussions with people, sometimes arguments with people. And I'm trying to find my way to, you know, figuring out what I'm thinking. And a lot of these essays, you know, this essay collection covers about 25 years of work. There are pieces in here in which I say, well, you know, 20 years ago, I said this. I apologize for saying that. I was wrong. And now, you know, I've changed my mind. And here's some of the reasons why I've changed my mind. So I don't really think about, you know, trying to be current or trying to, you know, be in the swim or trying to align myself with this or that current. I'm trying to figure out actually what I think. And I'm trying to bring to the page the best of my thinking.
What's the most important thing you've changed your mind about in the last 25 years?
Oh, there are a number. But frankly, if I had to choose one, it would be the idea that people who have been oppressed and are suffering oppression can still be wrong. It's not as if oppression, you know, immunizes you against, you know, human vice. It's a mistake to think that those who've been kicked around, those who've been held down, are, because of their experience, going to be ennobled. We'd have a better world if that's true, if that were true. It's not true. I'm African American. My people have been, you know, dealt with in a very terrible way throughout the history of this country. That doesn't prevent African Americans, however, from being wrong about things or from doing bad things.
You explore in several essays critiques of African-American community, African-American leaders by other African-Americans, and those critiques often accusing folks of giving ammunition to white supremacy or to opponents. When you lay out the kind of argument you did for me just here, do you open yourself to that critique? And I suspect you were expecting that question.
I wasn't expecting the question, but it's a good question. The fact of the matter is, yes, there are people who say that my writings give ammunition to the enemies of racial justice. I think I've made it very clear in my writings that I think of myself as a champion of racial justice. Racial oppression, like I said at the outset, has been a terrible menace to our democracy. Still, you know, it is the African Americans are people too, and you know, African Americans can be wrong. And I don't feel any hesitancy in stating when I think that people are wrong, even people who are terribly oppressed. So one of the essays in my book, for instance, is about Nat Turner. Now, you know, I asked the question, should we revere Nat Turner? Should we view Nat Turner as a hero? I say no, actually, we ought not. Now, I'm sure that some people are going to be upset with that and against that. Now,
he led a bloody rebellion, just for listeners who may not know who Nat Turner was.
That's right. He led a bloody rebellion in 1830. And my argument is, I'm not a pacifist. It would have been fine for him to have led a bloody rebellion. But I think that some of the tactics that he and his colleagues use were bad, even in the grip of enslavement. Now, one of the things I like about that essay is I point out that there were other Black people at that time who also were critical of Nat Turner. So it's not a question of, you know, the good guys, the bad guys, we choose sides and that's all there is to it. Life is complicated. There are nuances. There is bad with good people. Good people can do bad things. Again, I luxuriate in the messiness of life.
So one of the reasons I'm glad you brought up the Nat Turner example is the essays really do cover an incredible scope of then and now. So you have a Nat Turner all the way to George Floyd. You have a Frederick Douglass all the way to Clarence Thomas. And I want to talk about that one a little because there are two essays on the Supreme Court I want to touch on. One is called Inequality and the Supreme Court. And the other, the first one we can talk about, is called rather sharply, Why Clarence Thomas Ought to Be Ostracized. I thought that was some of your strongest condemnation was for the Associate Justice. Is that fair?
Yes, that's very fair. It's
and
very
why?
Fair. I don't think I criticize anybody in this book more harshly than I criticize Justice Clarence Thomas, and I stand by that criticism. I think that Justice Thomas has been party to a terrible set of rulings that have pushed back the struggle for racial justice. And so, yes, I think that Clarence Thomas ought to be ostracized. And I make the argument for that.
So at one level, that almost seems like a political argument. And there is a sort of a touching on the question of the political history of the court, how much it's been a political body, how much it is a political body. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. The Supreme Court of the United States is one of the, you know, great power wielders in our society. Is it political? Of course it's political. The law is a crystallization of our politics. So I reject a sharp distinction between law on the one hand and politics on the other. The Supreme Court of the United States, how do you get on the Supreme Court? You get on the Supreme Court because electoral politicians nominate you and confirm you. It's thoroughly political. And I think it's you know, the American public is mystified by the suggestion that the Supreme Court is not political. It is. And so when I judge the Supreme Court, I ask the question, you know, do I like their politics? But is it political? Sure it is.
Yeah, I don't mean to be naive, right? I understand that. At the same time, the idea of approaching the court as a political body somehow feels, especially with somebody with your authority, feels like it risks destabilizing us a little bit. We kind of count on the judiciary to be outside as much as possible that swoop of political forces.
That's mystification. We are searching for innocence. We are searching for stability. We're searching for something above politics. Guess what? That's a delusion. It's not there. And I would just simply tell people, get used to it. That's just reality. The Supreme Court of the United States, you know, does it pursue its politics differently than the presidency? Yes. Does it pursue its politics differently than the legislative branch? Yes. It has different traditions. It has different customs. It has a different rhetoric. But is it thoroughly political? Yes. I mean, if it wasn't, why do we have the battles that we have regarding who's going to be on the Supreme Court? If it wasn't political, it wouldn't matter that much. But it is political. And at some level, we all know that.
So I think you know that Justice John Roberts has talked instead about the court being umpires, not making the rules, applying them. That sounds like an argument, a plea almost, for people to see the court as apolitical. Are you aware of his arguments like that? And what's your response to those?
Oh, absolutely. Of course, I'm aware of them. And Justice Breyer, just to go to another, you know, part of the ideological spectrum, just published a book in which he talks about, you know, the perils of politics. You know, let the court be above politics. I say to both of them, that's ridiculous. The Supreme Court of the United States has always been political. You give me the subject, you give me the issue, and I can suggest to you a probability about how the court is going to come out. Why is that? Why is it that the Supreme Court of the United States today leans in a certain direction with respect to racial issues, gender issues, organized labor issues? Why is it that it has its lean? It has its lean because Republican presidents have been able to appoint a majority conservative Republican Supreme Court.
And you point out in one of your essays, that's a matter of pure numbers, that Republican presidents have appointed more court members.
Well, that's true. And that has consequences. And all I'm saying is we should not be surprised. We should not be surprised when, you know, conservative jurists come out with, you know, conservative opinions.
All right. In our remaining time, I want to get at least one question into you about college campuses, since they are so relevant to Greater Boston. You write about them, and you at least partially confront progressive action on campuses. For example, you talk about Princeton. I read you in your essays as saying that the movement to call out racism on campuses has in some cases gone too far or fails to acknowledge the progress also made for Black and Brown scholars on campuses. Is that a fair read?
I think that is a fair read. Yes, it's a fair read. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Keep thinking.
I was going to say that, yes, that's a fair read. Again, is racism a menace in our society, a large menace in our society? Yes, it is, and it needs to be confronted. To confront it effectively, however, it's going to be very important not to exaggerate. It's going to be very important to recognize progress where there has been progress, and it's going to be very important to have discipline and not engage in, for instance, coercion even if you have the power to be coercive. So even if you have the power to silence your ideological enemies on campus, I say to progressives, and I consider myself a progressive, don't do it. Exercise self-discipline. We want to have open universities. We want to have an open intellectual environment. To do that, we're all going to have to be self-disciplined and respect freedom of expression, freedom of thought, freedom to read, freedom to listen.
And what response do you get from students and colleagues when you make that argument?
Well, some applaud and some boo.
Fair enough. So, all right, in our remaining time, what's next for you? What are you thinking about or writing about next?
I've been working for a number of years on a book about the Second Reconstruction. I'm 1 year away from finishing a book that'll respond to the following question. How did the protests against racial injustice in the mid-20th century change American law? And in a year's time, I will finish my manuscript and ship that off to my publisher.
Well, when it's done, I hope you'll come back. That's Harvard Law Professor Randall Kennedy. His new book, a collection of essays, is titled Say It Loud, on Race, Law, History, and Culture. It's out today. Professor Kennedy, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.